The craft of writing is not going to go away, but where and how it's seen is sure changing. And creative writing? Is Alaska a creative writing frontier? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we're exploring the frontiers of creative writing in Alaska. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide, toll-free. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Social media-wise, email talk@alaskapublic.org. UAA Creative Writing MFA teachers talk with us today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, because we have writers in the house, I'm going to abandon my usual ambush question methodology and instead go to the written introduction, like Ray Suarez used to do, and I used to enjoy so much. So here's a quick list of some of the forces that could lead to a unique Alaska literature. We are in the West, at the literal end of the colonial impulse. Russia, France, Great Britain, Spain all reached here before the tide of manifest destiny spent itself as well in the frozen north. The land still has unexplored places. It is unexhausted. We are uniquely multicultural, a land where people still have their own languages, yet modern telecommunications also begin to span the land. We have a wide spectrum of faith and belief. The culture is now becoming more mature and more solid. We have a considerable geographic drama. We have volcanoes going off. We have earthquakes. We have geological and biological drama, along with a seasonal swing, which is beyond easy imagination for those in more temperate latitudes. The nature of literature and communications itself is changing. There are new forms, not just creative nonfiction, but microfiction, all sorts of journalistic invention, and a budding international intercultural vocabulary of collage and sampling, hip-hop, and of course the remarkable evolution of the media that carry these communications. We got social media, we got drastically changing carriers of advertising, intelligence services, and publishing. So now we turn to teaching creative writing. And I started by saying the craft of writing is not going to go away. I have with me Joanne Mapson, author of Blue Rodeo, The Wilder Sisters, and other books, and Sherry Simpson, author of The Accidental Explorer, and I think a forthcoming book on bears very soon. And they both teach at the University of Alaska Anchorage Low Residency Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program. Sherry, I guess we'll start with you because we've had you on before, and you can do the 101 on this as to what a low residency program actually consists of. I mean, this is kind of a special week because these people are actually physically present with one another, I guess.
That's right. It's kind of a combination of boot camp and summer camp. So it's fun and exhilarating and exhausting, and you need to go away and be quiet afterward. But the reason is that we switched from a traditional program where you have classes 3 hours a week and graduate students who live on campus to a low residency program, which has two big parts. One is the on-campus residency where all the teachers and students come together for 12 days and we talk and have classes and readings, and we talk and have classes and readings. And then we pair our students up with an individual teacher, a writer, and then that writer mentors the individual student through the rest of the year. They exchange work and comments and come back rejuvenated and ready to progress with a new mentor. So it's still a three-year program, but it's a kind of program that makes it more possible for a wider variety of people to attend and to finish a degree. It's more like real life, writing in real life.
Can you keep the same mentor if you want for all 3 years?
No, we try to discourage that. In our traditional program, that was what happened. All the poor nonfiction students had me for 3 years.
Hey, I hear them thank you all the time.
Well, they're terrific, but nobody should operate in a monoculture. And although we always required students to take classes in other genres, we think it's much better if you can move from mentor to mentor and learn new styles and new perspectives on your work. And we're surprised and gratified by how well that model seems to work.
Joanne Mapson, I want to turn to you and ask you about, I mean, I view you as a professional writer, you know, like going back down through the years, maybe coming out of journalism. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
I was always a writer. As a child, I wrote lots of poems and stories and used them to get out of assignments at school. I began writing seriously probably at about age 25, and mostly stories at that point. I won a short story award in California, and the prize that I won was a computer, the early ones, where you didn't have hardware. It was all software. And it really changed my life. I was able to write my first novel. And, of course, it was terrible and didn't sell. But the second one did.
Wow. Well, I think of you as a writer of romances. Are you comfortable with that?
If you talk about the term romance, what it really means, which is adventure and not bodice rippers, certainly. I have a romance.
You wouldn't pass up the bodice ripper. You wouldn't pass up a little bodice ripping here and there, would you? Your ladies, the ones I read about, are a bit on the horny side.
I don't want that on the cover.
Well, I get the feeling that there's a code or a genre. To me, I look at the covers of your books, and I know this is pretty much the publisher's decision what it's going to look like. Because they were the one that's making a product out of it. But nonetheless, that I really think a guy is probably going to hesitate before picking this book up. And it's more going to be a woman that wants to pick this up, just from the presentation of it.
Well, if he's really a smart man, he'll pick it up.
Ooh. Well, that's what I'm finding out. I'm reading The Wilder Sisters. I'm just enjoying the heck out of it. I don't know how old it is, even. It's Santa Fe area set in.
It was 1996, I think.
Sometime back.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm getting to know the characters. I'm happy with them. I'm sure I'll be sorry to part company with them by the end of the book unless they die or something. Some of them.
Can I share with you my Oprah story about that book?
Absolutely.
Okay. I was at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books on a panel with other women writers, and Oprah and her entourage came into the panel halfway through and sat down at the same time as I was asked, why is your character Lily such a slut? I knew I was doomed, and I said, well, she's just kind of friendly. Then everyone noticed Oprah was there, and that was the end. She did use me as a human shield to move from that building to the next one. That was my Oprah moment.
What a story. What a story. Well, you're with the superstars this week. You know, usually you bring in an extra one. I mean, what is the Linda Hogan did the keynote, I noticed. Well, and has she taught in the MFA program before?
She has a long history of teaching in various programs.
Well,
but part of our model that I think is different than a lot of low residency models across the country is we wanted some real cross-pollination, and we wanted to help students think about what it means to be creative and to think outside their own heads. So every year we have three different guest artists come. Linda Hogan was our keynote. Usually we have a literary person as our major person. Last year was Gary Snyder. But we also invite photographers and musicians and people in other creative arts and even sciences, because we want to stimulate our students to think a little bit wider than just their computer screen. So, for example, one of our guest artists coming up is Gary Freeberg, who's a fantastic landscape photographer, and he'll be taking our students out for his craft talk. and helping them see new ways to see the world. So we hope to have people like John Adams come in the future, that sort of thing. So it's a way of feeding your creative instinct.
You could have either John Adams come,
I
suppose.
Exactly. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You know, I like, it seems to me in the nonfiction area, which, as you point out, is you were the only teacher up for a while.
Mm-hmm.
There's maybe a little bit more of a bonanza or a little bit more material, a little bit more of a frontier and new ground to be broken, especially in Alaska.
Yeah. One of our colleagues, Ann Kasten, who's a poet, says she thinks that nonfiction is the genre for Alaska. But I do think that's changing a lot. And I think nonfiction in the state is changing a lot, too. It was pretty easy to write travelogues or memoirs that are about homesteading, and those are all valuable stories. But now I think the stories are getting more complicated, and we're looking in more corners of the state for variety of stories. So, and the literary writing, I think, has changed that landscape. Joanne has more experience outside, a good outsider perspective and an insider perspective. Do you think that's true, Joanne? Or?
I think it's true, and there's also some other forces at work. I moved up here in 2000, and the landscape is unbelievable. It always has been. Hopefully it always will be. And I thought, how can I ever write about Alaska? It's just too big. It would overpower any book I tried to write. Well, in the MFA program that we teach in, another sort of base foundation is setting. And Alaska certainly lends itself to that. And I think with the exchange of ideas from visiting writers who also look at that, we have sort of broken the ice on that.
I think that whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction, there's material. You need material. I mean, you take a Dana Stabenow, is like, you know, she's always mining. She goes for the latest stuff.
Right.
Throws them in there. And we've had her in here, and she says, and I say, how could anybody possibly be interested in this trivial Alaska stuff you put in your book? She says, they love it. They can't get enough.
That's absolutely true.
It's material.
I think there's also, in the past, there's been a prejudice. Western writers referred to as regional in New York. I see that breaking up. Same thing with Alaska.
Yeah.
So I see that changing as well. And more writers that are coming out of our state are international. Eowyn Ivey, for example, her book The Snow Child was nominated for the Pulitzer, her first novel. And she's an Alaskan. So right. It's exciting.
There's also getting to be a multicultural tone to a lot of it.
Finally.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And one of our long-term goals is to find ways to let Alaska Native writers find a voice and a form and a genre and an audience. And that's starting to happen, too. Ernestine Hayes was one of our graduates, and then she was also, until this year, one of our associate faculty. Her memoir, Blonde Indian, was a winner of the American Book Award. And she was also a finalist for the Pacific Rim Kimura Prize, I think it was. That's huge. And her memoir talks about a part of Alaska that doesn't get talked about very often. And that was her experiences growing up in Juneau. Her mother went to she had tuberculosis, went to a sanitarium. She left the state. She found her way home. It's a beautiful memoir, beautifully written, and written in a style that's completely her style. And it's a new vision of Alaska. And the same with Joan Kane, who will be one of our guest speakers coming up. A young woman, she went outside and studied. Her family's from King Island, and I think Mary's Igloo. She just had this successful Kickstarter program to take family members back to King Island and investigate those old stories, bring them back to life, gather memories, but then transform them into art. So moving from oral history into a written record and a transformed record of what happened artistically. So those are new things on the landscape for sure, and something we really hope to to encourage to do a better job of?
Yeah, I think it's I think you couldn't even hold it back, to tell you the truth. It's just in the nature of the forces that are going. So it's more a question of getting the tools in the hands, and you know, failure rates that are always going to happen. I mean, everybody tries stuff that doesn't work and so forth, but they got to want to try first. And
right.
We're at that stage where there are a number who really want to try.
That's right. And I think you're exactly right about the tools. We want little kids to start thinking about being a writer, to have that dream, because for so many writers, it's been a lifelong urge. And then we're there to help shape that. And the undergraduate curriculums, high school curriculum, those all, the curricula really matter in that aspect too. So we're kind of the end stage of that, where we can help launch them into their careers as writers, but they need that encouragement early too.
Well, I have to say that writing to me is not necessarily tied that closely with the educational system. I realize that we're dealing with an educational institution here, but at the same time, I'm not really sure that schools are the best place to encourage the engagement and the imagination, and that all that huge kind of effort that a person would put into that as opposed to an assignment. Now, every once in a while, you might get a really gifted teacher, or a teacher that just really wants to find the best coming out of a person, but that's not all that common. Well, and nowadays, the schools are all going, you know, like it's all about teach to test.
Right. Yeah, you're right about that. That aspect is concerning. But Joanne, what were you going to say?
I was going to say Peggy Shoemaker.
Yeah.
I think that she's kind of like the grandmother of all of this. She was Sherry's advisor. She has made it a point to use her facilities to have books given away, books published. She has her own press, right?
She's an acquiring editor for Boreal Books, which is an imprint of Red Hen Press, but also she's shepherding the Alaska Literary Series at a University of Alaska Press, which is a huge part, I think, of what's changing on our literary landscape right now.
And she's very supportive, and she doesn't go away. It isn't like a one-time thing.
That's what I was talking about when I talked about we're starting to get a little bit of mass, a little cultural mass, persistence, stuff that doesn't go away, the Nunatak of the culture, you know?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, that is resistant, and it's there because it's got a force.
I think the Rasmussen Foundation is also pivotal in that. I'm currently working with a writer, Leslie Kimiko Ward, and her project was funded by Rasmussen after they saw her do a one-person play. They came to her.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It is awesome.
There is a sort of synthesis of forces, I think. It's the writer laureates, different. Take on a project. So Nancy Lord, who's probably our preeminent nonfiction writer in the state, she's always been a supporter of libraries. So she focused on that. John Straley from Sitka focused on going to schools. They all take on a different project, and they all have their inflections on what happens. They're all building up. So between the writer laureate and then Rasmussen supporting, recognizing those efforts, our program, the program at UAF, I think the Homer Writers Conference has been huge on the landscape. There's a new one in Skagway, Northwards, I think. So those all encourage and bring people from outside. Eowyn Ivey met her agent at the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference. So
I think it's great when they come in from outside.
Yeah, it is.
They get a different impression. The landscape is different when you first experience it. And those are impressions that really need to get down. And it was really good. I enjoyed it when Linda McCarriston and Gretchen Legler first got here. Ron Spatz came in and he was all excited. It's going to change everything. I got these two great people. I convinced the university to bring them in. And everything's going to change. And he was right. Everything did change. But Gretchen and Mary Beth Holloman.
Mary Beth, yep.
Had a outdoor writing workshop that they would conduct. And that didn't mean that you were writing about your fishing trip and your bear encounters. That meant that you had to go outside and sit down and write.
Right.
I thought, you know, something's finally going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's AQR, Ron Spatz, those early writers who came in the departments, those are our literary forebears.
Right.
Nora Marks Dauenhauer and Richard Dauenhauer, very early on the scene, and now she's our writer laureate. He was a poet laureate. John Haynes, Sheila Nickerson, they started making these inroads. Richard Nelson, The Island Within, those had a huge effect. And they also showed people like me growing up who could write about.
You're the one that has to write this history.
Well, I'm just glad to be part of it. You know, I grew up in Juneau. We moved there when I was 7, and I stayed in the state, went to UAF, and then see how things have changed in my lifetime is pretty exciting.
I'm reminded that I haven't said what we're talking about or who we're talking to for a long time, or that our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Our email is talk@alaskapublic.org. However, if you send an email to me at the office, it doesn't get here. I'm looking at the other email, so I always feel bad when there's emails that come to me at my workstation and I haven't seen them during the show. And they're often really terrific. But we have with us Sherry Simpson, who was just talking, author of The Accidental Explorer, and Joanne Mapson, author of Blue Rodeo, The Wilder Sisters, and many others, and living now in Santa Fe. But they're both teaching at the Low Residency Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program, UAA. And they're having readings. What is it called? The Northern Renaissance? Something like that. Northern Renaissance Arts and Sciences readings. And they started on Sunday night, and they continue pretty much each evening all through this week and on into next week. And among the things that happen is the students get to read. Now, so I want to invite listeners to engage on the issue of what an Alaska literature might consist of. Is one emerging, and what are the signs of it, and all that sort of thing. And we had Joan Kane on here. We had Don Reardon on here. We're going to have Tom Keziah next week. And that's a very interesting piece of nonfiction. That one's going to make a bit of a splash, I think so.
And I think it goes to the themes you were talking about in that wonderful introduction. You know, he has an opportunity in an event, an unusual event, the Pilgrim family and the drama that surrounded it. But he is exploring ideas of frontier and wilderness, people's conceptions of what it means to come to Alaska, to be in Alaska, to be an Alaskan. And I think that's the sort of thing a lot of writers are exploring now. But I think one sign of the state's success is we have very successful writers who don't write about Alaska, but who live here. Andromeda Romano Lax would be one. David Marusik, a science fiction writer, has an international reputation. He lives in Fairbanks. So we think that's an exciting feature, is that they live here. Surely they're informed by living here, but they write about other subjects and are successful critically and commercially.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just because you're in Alaska doesn't mean you need to be pinholed as
that's
pigeonholed
right.
That you're gonna do this.
That's exactly right. And I think that is one of the constraints that can happen if you are an Alaska writer who wants to write in a different vein or a literary vein, getting beyond those sort of stereotypes of what Alaska is like, what it means to be here, to explore, as Tom's book will, I'm sure, some of the contemporary issues of how we see Alaska and live in Alaska, too. And that's very important.
Well, also, it's from a journalistic point of view,
mm-hmm.
you're just ultimately trying to figure out what actually happened, you know,
yes.
and seeing it through somebody else's eyes, what was in this one's head and what was in that one's head and how could they possibly have and how did this develop and what did so-and-so think of it and on like that. But it ends up reflecting on the lot. Why did this capture people's imagination? Why was he able? How did he come up with this weird metaphor of the biblical family and the backwoods and trying to find the most remote places, and where's the selfishness and where's the deception, and it all, it's because there's an enigma, that all this can be done. It's just like with that bus out at the end of the Stampede Road. You know, no, we're going to continue to be fascinated with it. You know,
that's
and
right.
I go, every time I bring it up, I start calling up and say, "Get rid of that damn thing! It's not horrible. All those people are idiots." Whatever. It's not that simple.
That's right. But you're exactly right. There's elements in all of these stories that capture a national imagination, right, and that intrigue everyone at some level.
Or we could bring up bears, which I'm going to do later on. Because
right.
I know you're primed for that one. But first, I want to go to this business of the writer and the writer's craft. So being a mentor, Joanne.
Yes.
What does it consist of? How does it differ from being, say, an editor?
It's a much more intimate relationship. It's one writer speaking to another writer. The mentor maybe has more experience in published books, and the mentee, the student, is developing her own work, conversing with you. It's very intimate, and you do it at a distance. You're not ever seeing each other. It's just over the internet. And I think that makes it even more intimate. There's things that you can write that you can't say. And I'm as changed by the experience as the students are.
So do you, I guess you establish a schedule with the...
A number of mailings, usually 9 over a year's time.
Mail? You do it by mail?
Well... We call it mail, email, or you can actually. I think there's one of our fiction professors who prefers to receive the pages. I always print the pages out because that's how
I don't like
how
reading
I edit.
Any kind of extended thing. I want to have that pen in my
hand. It's a different process editing online than it is with a pen in your hand.
It is.
So then we, you know, mail back to the student.
But as I recall, what you said that getting a computer actually changed your life in terms of being a writer.
Absolutely.
So you were enabled by that technology.
I used to type my short stories on onion skin, send them out. When they came back wrinkled and horrible, I'd iron them, send them back again. Yes, it changed my life.
I love it. That is so literal, you know. I mean, a lot of people don't even know what onion skin is.
I just stand there ironing.
Let's get a call in here from Homer. Melanie joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Sherry and Joanne.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm not sure. I didn't hear the question that you meant to start with. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Just what would an Alaska literature consist of, and is one starting to emerge?
Okay. I'm calling because I heard a comment that you said about the public school system and how writing may or may not be encouraged.
Right.
And I am calling because I have a 13-year-old son who's gone through the school system, public school system in Homer, and actually excels on all the standards-based assessments and has been encouraged incredibly throughout his school years by every single one of his teachers to be a writer, to be able to express himself and to be able to describe what he sees and to be the best writer that he can be with daily promptings and daily feedback. And I think by saying the public school system is not giving a good foundation for that, in Homer anyway, is not accurate.
Well,
and
by
I just
golly,
really wanted to put that out there.
All right. Well, you told me. Yeah, that's one of those I'm here to tell you kind of phone calls. I'll take that.
But that's great to hear.
Yeah. It is.
I think it's critically important. And I bet every single writer has had a teacher who told them, "You can do it. You can write." Got them excited about books and got them excited about writing that way.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled to hear that. I was
Sheila
Nickerson
came. I think
came
pretty much every teacher that my child has had, and as I said, he's going into eighth grade, and he's been in the public school system. Every single teacher has done that, and I think that they do that. That Homer teachers really pride themselves on producing or encouraging good writers. So, yeah.
Well, some of our best writers have come out of Homer, so I'm not surprised, but I'm thrilled.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Melanie, thanks for standing up for good old Homer.
Yeah. Thanks,
all right,
Melanie.
Thank you.
Bruce, right, has a comment. My online book, I can't say, has some unique information about working inside the Hammond and Knowles administrations. Mm-hmm. Online publishing allows for an easier way to publish behind-the-scenes accounts at the change of history. Well, by golly, it does. I think the problem is nobody's worked out the financial part of it.
Well, Joanne could speak to that more than I can because she's one of the few writers I know who can make a living publishing. So she's much more in tune with that.
It's not a fabulous living. I don't have a Mercedes.
You live in Santa Fe, for Pete's sake.
I live in the poor part of Santa Fe. Actually, where I live, they call it the White Reservation because there's so many old people living there.
Aww.
White hair. Gosh, well, online, I have to say, when Jeff Kleinman came to the Kachemak Bay Conference, he's a literary agent, he gave a talk on how print books are dead. And we all, you know, were horrified to hear that. There's, you know, you don't want anybody to mess with a book. You want it to remain an object that you can put on your shelf and pull out. But shortly after that, I bought a Kindle because I have over 2,000 books in my library. And my husband said, that's it. And sometimes their typography is a little bit off. I think that all the publishing industries are trying to get used to it. Amazon figured out a way to make money off it. And who knows? A couple of my books, when they finished out their print runs, are now print on demand, which costs more. So people buy the Kindle or the online version a lot more than they used to. And
so that's print on demand. It's fascinating. So it's geared up like the Walmart warehouses or whatever. It's read the supply line all the way from the fabrication to the client.
Yeah, it's all really. I'm hoping it's.
I guess that's probably going to get even more that way.
I'm hoping it's a good change.
Joe McGinnis in here. He says this is nothing but good for me.
Yeah.
He said,
well, right. I think as long as you can streamline the path to publication with the editor, it will be more cost effective for everybody.
And the publishers they're still gatekeepers, and a lot of ways they're even worse gatekeepers because they're so nervous and worried, and so maybe people are just bypassing them more and more now.
Well, Barnes & Noble's been having an argument with, I think it's Simon & Schuster, for months and months. But I'm all for that kind of paradigm, print on demand.
1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about developing Alaska writers as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
We're talking about what might constitute an Alaska literature. There's Alaska impressions of Alaska. There's the writers and how they are informed by Alaska, even if they don't write about Alaska. And we're getting around to the vision thing here, I think. From Justin Oldham comes this email. Glad to hear you're talking about literature with Alaska themes. Tales from the Kodiak Starport was my first foray into Alaska-style fiction. I think we make worthwhile investments in our state's future by writing about our vision of that long-term potential and what it may take to make those dreams a reality. Wow.
That's a great comment.
Science fiction. He's a science fiction writer. In Kodiak, you know, elaborating on this, which is speculating on
right.
There being a spaceport. There already so is. Well, Kodiak Island. Let's go to Libby, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Kodiak Island. Let's go to Libby, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Libby.
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I am heading out even today down to the Island Institute in Sitka, which I bet you guys are familiar with. Yeah, that's been 25, 30 years using, you know, community, the written word to help us heal what's happening to the planet, particularly the environment. And I just wanted to pick your brains as part of this because they're bringing together this time 9 writers, 2 of us are Alaskan, with the task of working with the community to come up with some ideas around what they're calling a literature of resilience. And really the question is, you know, given what's happening environmentally speaking particularly, and up here, of course, it's happening really rapidly in terms of climate change and ocean acidification and blah, blah, mining. Do we need new stories to help people really respond and address what we need to do to make sure we have a biosphere for our children and grandchildren? Do we need new format, new content? How can we use our stories to challenge the dominant worldview and help people see things in new ways with new options, that kind of thing? So I just thought with your two brilliant minds and thinking about resilience in terms of our communities, if we have major impacts to salmon or, you know, with climate change issues going on in the bush so rapidly, just your thoughts on that, if you see Alaskan writers rising to that challenge or maybe we could help them do that.
Who wants to start?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the Sitka Institute. When I was, I started out as a newspaper reporter, and when I became interested in trying to become a better writer, I went there a few times. And in fact, Linda Hogan, who was our guest writer this year, I saw her first there. And they have, for decades now, taken on those big questions. And some of our state's best writers have been influenced by them, including Seth Kantner, who was a participant 1 year when I was there as well. His book, Ordinary Wolves, was one of the first, I think, to kind of take on some of the issues you're talking about, Libby.
Yeah.
But then look at Maymay Evans. Her novel, Oil and Water, came out this year. Well, that's directly addressing those conflicts that concern not just Alaskans, but everyone, really. What are the limits of resource use? Who's hurt? What do we need? How do we change our ideas about these things? Marjorie Kowalski-Cole, who is a Fairbanks writer who passed on, wrote an environmental work of fiction, environmental subject, I mean. It wasn't
Isn't
a polemic.
Isn't that the one that won the Barbara Kingsolver Prize?
That's right. It won the Bellwether Award.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah, which was a huge prize, and it's given to writers who tackle these important themes in fiction. So there's somebody who's also been informed by those conflicts you're talking about. And I think absolutely we do need new stories. And in some ways, these are old stories, but new ways of thinking about them. Because the things that have concerned Americans and people all over the world for a long time, we can see those being worked out yet again in Alaska. And our hope is always we have can use our imagination to maybe think of new solutions.
We run out of chances. We got to do it right up here.
That's right.
Ernestine Hayes, who was a graduate of our program and the author of Blonde Indian, published a children's book recently called The Country Bear and the City Bear.
Yeah, I think, or The Town Bear, maybe. I can't remember, but right.
And I think that in itself is like the bedrock, the place to start. And that book does talk about, you know, the deal with bears coming into areas and then, you know, they no longer can go back to the wild. And children read that, and they're hungry for more. I'm awfully proud of that.
I'm glad you mentioned that book. Yeah.
Well, you know, what Libby's talking about is trying to concentrate on resilience and whether resilience is something that you can build towards or reach out for. It's a difficult. First off, it's a really vague word.
Well, I think part of that is the reader. You know, sometimes fiction is the best vehicle for getting across that information, using it as plot, using it in character, and sometimes it's nonfiction, the essay that is specific and explains facts. But then there's also children. You know, we have a whole different way of relating to children in terms of reading. They first listen. So all of those things, I think, make a contribution to that.
And part of its cultural resilience, one important thing about Ernestine's book was it's a children's book, but it was also translated into Tlingit. And in her memoir, she's talking about what it means to be Tlingit in the modern culture and how do you come back to culture. It's really a story of her coming back home and also to an identity that's important. So those are also part of this resilience question,
Maybe the word is subtext. There's a sort of an eco-catastrophe that looms in the subconscious fog, and some people are so hopeless they want, I'm going to get mine while I can. And people are like lose hope, they become bitter, and the paradigm or let's take that fog that has the eco-catastrophe in it and see if we can. If there's possible to find something called resilience in that fog. And I don't know. Libby, is that kind of what you're looking for, is reaching into the fog?
Yeah, well, I think, as you say, all of us are aware, consciously or subconsciously, that our life systems are under a great deal of duress.
And right.
I think we're trying to, as Sherry mentioned, you know, use the power of imagination here to help people both imagine options that prevent that from happening. I mean, you know, we're in Sitka, and last year they had the same gathering, and we were talking about community resilience. And, you know, what happens in Sitka if the salmon start to go down like they have in the rest of the country? How does that community stay alive? How does it stay buoyant? How do it support one another? How does it ensure that cultural resilience of all the different peoples there? How do we form new ideas about our relationship to economics? How do we, mm-hmm. you know, all those kinds of things. You know, things are changing pretty rapidly around the planet. I think we're all finally making the links, right? A lot of extreme weather, a lot of big challenges. And so how do we picture going forward in ways that feel life-affirming and hold our neighbors' hands and, you know, figure this out together, food security, all of that.
It would seem to require some imagination and creativity.
And I think there are certain things we take for granted. In this literature resilience group, I am tasked with the question, helping people talk about the question of something they're calling radical imaginaries. And I don't even totally understand what it means, but I picked it because it sounds really juicy.
Wow.
A good name for a band, one or the other.
Yeah. And I think what it really means is, you know, how do we... There are many things we take for granted, like, for example, private property, just to be radical, or profit, or that each one of us needs to figure out our lives individually. I'm speaking economically at this moment, but, you know, and maybe those things need to be rethought for us to go forward in a healthy way. You know, we need to be able to reimagine our story, right? Our collective story, our human story, our individual stories. So, we don't really know what we're talking about, right? This is the cusp I think we're all working on, is what, you know, we are living a narrative, and we're all operating under what they would call an imaginary, where we have this sort of imaginary construction of understanding what's happening every day. You know, we get up, we go to jobs, we do these things inside of a construction that we've all agreed on, and we might need to change that. And I feel very lucky in Alaska because we have 10,000 years of Alaska's native peoples with a different story,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have something to work off of that looks different. It's just the sort of capitalist mainstream story isn't the only one there is. So maybe we could all join together and find new ones to go forward.
I think about, for some reason, I'm thinking about the people I see from other cultures, primarily Asian cultures, who know a whole lot more about foraging, stuff that grows in Alaska than I do. And they just got here. But, I mean, they're out there poking around in the bushes. I don't know what they're getting, but I'm sure it's worth it, whatever it is. And I'm thinking, you know, we have many multicultural resources. If we were just to try and that does contribute to resilience. That, in a very, very concrete way, contributes to resilience.
Well, and they deliberately down at this place have brought together people from very different ethnic backgrounds and other kinds of backgrounds for that reason, right, that we need to hear all the stories and hear all the ways people can imagine the human community and the natural community living and working together.
So, Libby, when does this thing start down in Sitka?
Tomorrow.
Oh, boy. Boy, it is the season, isn't it?
Mm.
It's popping along. Any more you want to add?
No, just thanks a lot for doing this series, and thanks both of you for responding.
Thanks for your good work. I think what you're talking about is very exciting, and I think it is really important for us to change the kind of dominating stories. And I don't want it for Alaska to be primarily a story of loss, of nostalgia, and of regret. And we have that opportunity to change that, and I think story is a way people respond to.
I would also add on to that that art is another way to communicate that. Mm-hmm. I think of Ray Troll right off the bat, and we laugh at his designs, but they're ecological. They have a subtext.
Oh, big time.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, I think that's a good point to take a break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Joanne Mapson and Sherry Simpson, both published writers and both teaching creative writing at the University of Alaska Anchorage in the Low Residency MFA program right now, and doing readings every evening. This is like intense, an intense workshop that's going on for the students and for the mentors as well. And everybody gets to do readings. We mentioned just briefly, Sherry, earlier that you've been working on something involving bears for some time. And you might read some of that when your turn comes around?
Yeah, I think I will.
And you're reading when?
When am I reading? The last night. I think it's next Tuesday, the 23rd.
I'm trying to talk you into it. Okay, so it's a week from today.
Yeah, and it will be, I'll be reading, and so will Nancy Lord and Joanne Mapson.
Boy.
So we're the final evening. We're the series closers.
Oh, wow.
Power position.
I've got the closers with me. Wow, I'm honored. So tell me a little bit, if you can. Because you've been working on this for a long time.
Decades, it feels like. Yeah. Well, in the middle, I published this other book, and I was interested in how science feeds in this and current events. I do have a chapter about polar bears in it, but mostly I was interested in the ways that we think about bears and how they express our ideas about ourselves and about how we see Alaska. So this relates to this idea we're talking about with frontier and wilderness. Are we going to have the same old story of the West, where we see landscape as a commodity and wild animals as a commodity? Or can we think of new ways to live with animals and new ways to think about bears? So I talked with a bunch of scientists and bear viewing guides and hunters, and there's some in there about predator control. So it's about how we as people relate to an animal that's very different in our imaginations than it is in real life.
I have to say that there's something special about bear stories, period.
It's true. This state is built on bear stories. It's fascinating. Yeah. It's one of the things I talk about, too, and how often we cling to the worst stories about bears because they're most exciting, but they also seem familiar.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I wanted to do was look at that overly familiar story and see if there's a new way to imagine the way we live with wild animals in the state.
Yeah, I got to go to McNeil with my parents, and when John Shane was there with Larry.
Oh yes, they're both in this book.
And I would hope so.
Yeah.
And they were like trying to figure out what did they have a proper identity for their facility there at McNeil, but I would say that for me and for my wife and for my parents, there was a religious core in there.
I think it's life-changing. I think people have some simple ideas about bears that that ignore the complexities of how they live and also how willing they are to live with us. That's one of the things that I learned through doing the research here that absolutely shocked me, how tolerant bears really are. And I do have a chapter about urban bears in Juneau and Anchorage and the struggle that municipalities have to help.
Of course, you'd have to have
that,
wouldn't you?
Yeah, of course. And, you know, this struggle to help people figure out how to live with bears and not simply think it's us and them, we're the city, they're the wilderness. It's much more porous than that. And so I think we do have a chance to really change the way we live with animals in a good way and be a terrific model for the rest of the United States.
For some reason, the word resilient is popping into my head again.
It so is. And, you know, bears are one reason they capture my imagination. They're among the most resilient of mammals. They're one of the most successful mammals ever. And they have accompanied us through history since the time we were both on this planet trying to figure out how to live together.
Is the book done?
It is finally done. I am supposed to be proofreading it right this second.
Well, all right.
But it will be out, I think, in October from the
University Press of Kansas.
I would love to.
That would be great.
I could talk anyone into the ground about bears because they're so much fun to talk about.
And hopefully you deflect it from, because the minute, it's just like if I say the bus, everybody calls up and get rid of the damn thing. If I say Treadwell, they say, oh, God, you're such an idiot. What do you, you know?
Exactly.
You can't get them off of it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're fascinated by those stories, and we all have our ideas about them. And I'm just hoping to enlarge people's ideas about bears and about ourselves.
You can't get people to realize that you just became angry over something that some fool did out there.
Right. Right.
And it affected you personally.
Right. And I do think partly it's because of the mainstream ideas and stories we have about those incidents. You know, Timothy Treadwell fashioned himself in a certain way, and what's clear to me now is that it was all about the bears, that the tolerance, what, you know, his ability to stay there season after season had everything to do with the bears.
Now you're getting me really, really interested.
Yeah,
okay, Joanne, you got to go up against that. What do you know what you're going to read yet?
I'm going to read something from my novel that comes out next year called Owen's Daughter. And I just wanted to add, I think resilience is the bedrock of fiction and poetry and nonfiction. If you didn't have resilience, where would your story be? It's just different kinds, and sometimes it's microscopic, and sometimes it's the big picture. But I write a lot about water now that I live in Santa Fe, and I tuck details into my fiction that I believe call attention to that and get people thinking, whether they want to or not.
It's a bit of an obsession in New Mexico, water.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so weird because then next door you go into Arizona where they have this huge dam and you wouldn't have the city of Phoenix without...
Yeah,
then you have the absurdity of Los Angeles.
That's been in the papers
water.
A lot lately
about
Arizona.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, water rights.
Walter Hickel might have been right about the water pipeline being our ultimate, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I constantly think. That's where our future lies.
Well, we got another call. Rudy joins the program from Ketchikan. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Rudy, with Sherry and Joanne.
Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Rudy.
Yeah, I just wanted to, the Craig Public Library had a Pitchapalooza a couple of years ago, and it inspired me. I had written a novel, a fiction novel in the 90s, and tried to pitch it all through the 2000s, and finally in the 2010s, this Pitchapalooza came along, and I redid it, and it's out on Amazon now.
Wow.
And what it was is that she brought some people in from New York that were it was, you know, and you had 1 minute to pitch your story, and it was, you know, it was a very inspiring thing, and so it got me off my duff again and got the book out there. Anyway, it's on Amazon now, and it's called Under Raven's Wing,
Under, and, okay, let me get that again. Under Raven's Wing?
Yes.
And that's by Rudy?
Sacomano, S-A-C-C-O-M-A-N-N-O.
God, what an inspiring tale.
That's terrific. Congratulations.
Good for you.
Yeah, so thank you so much for having this show. I mean, it's you know, the writers that are coming out of Alaska are very exciting, and I just hope to be one that gets out there and sold. So,
wow. Well,
and it's just not one for you.
Rudy, thanks for your call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, and he's using it. I mean, there, if you had a metaphor in Alaska to compete with the bear, it would be the raven, I would say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And look how well that worked for, you had Don Reardon on, which is terrific. He's one of our graduates. We couldn't be more thrilled at his success. And there,
Do we know, is it success? Do we know?
Oh, yeah. He's done very well.
Oh, because, I guess it was big in Canada, and then it came over here.
That's so. Right. It was just republished here this summer, but it's being translated into other languages. It's critically well-received, and it's about Bethel, where he grew up. It's a terrific
very,
book.
Very small piece of geography, and what he was pointing out that was very important to him is that looking at catastrophes differently.
Right.
Catastrophes of the past, and what does resilience really consist of? And so there's that word again. Thanks, Libby. There's that word again. Okay, well, we got enough time that we can get kind of a thumbnail of what you do. What you do, Duran. Like, we could have started out with this.
What I do in the residency?
I said romance.
Oh, romance. About my own writing?
You're right. How much time do you devote to that in a day? As much as you can, or
usually 4 hours. After that, I'm really not good for anything. I have a lot of dogs, and they come into the office around 2, and start reminding me that they're going to eat at 5. So I kind of work around that.
Uh-huh.
I love working. I really do. It's the best part of my day. I'm alone. I'm sitting there. The words are coming through me somehow. Turning out on the page. I have a very boring life. I have my writing and I walk my dogs. I think about romance, I think in the classical definition of it, where it's really more about adventure.
And Sherry, how about your flow? Do you value it when you get the flow going?
Oh, I do. And one of the things I love about the low residency program is I have most of the winter to work and to work with my students. And so it's incredibly helpful.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
All right.
You.
Next week, Pilgrim Family with Tom Kazaya. Thanks, Dave Waldron, Josh Edge. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Alaskan Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.